feel your energy draining, and you feel F-state creeping in, try any one of the following. Have a healthy snack. Fruit, veggies, hummus, nuts, a piece of dark chocolate. Do a quick burst of exercise. Take what Dr. John Rady calls a brain break. 25 fast jumping jacks, 10 quick push-ups, and a 1-minute burst of rapid running in place will instantly reset your brain. If you can't do that, try walking up and down stairs as fast as you can for 2 minutes. If you can't do that, go for a brisk walk through the building, or, even better, outdoors. Meditate or take a power nap. Just 5 minutes of meditation will revive you, and, when you see your thoughts floating by without attaching emotion to them, you gain a positive objectivity. If you are really tired, take a power nap. But beware, some people can't do this. They end up either wasting time or falling asleep for too long. If you can do it, though, set the alarm on your cell phone for 15 or 20 minutes and go to sleep. When it works, it does wonders. Enjoy a dose of Vitamin Connect. Call a friend. Chat with a colleague about something fun. Listen to a favorite piece of music. Yes, you can get Vitamin Connect from inanimate sources like music, art, photos, poetry, essays, even memories. Use drugs. I'm being a bit facetious here, but caffeine can provide a burst of energy. Just don't use it as your mainstay. And if you have ADHD, this may be the signal to take your next dose of Ritalin, Adderall, or whatever your doctor has prescribed. Listen to the appendix for a discussion of stimulants and other medications. Use humor. Laughter revives the mind wondrously well. Keep a joke book in your desk drawer, or go to YouTube and find something funny to look at. Experiment. Come up with remedies that work best for you. As long as they are safe and legal, anything goes. Beating unhappiness at work. Lining up your goals with your emotions and your emotions with your goals is critical. Otherwise, you will be stripping your gears throughout your life. You will never be able fully to focus on your goal and pursue it with a passion if your heart's not in it. Many years ago, Andrew Carnegie commissioned Napoleon Hill to interview 500 of the wealthiest, most successful individuals at the time, including Henry Ford, John D. Rockefeller, George Eastman, F.W. Woolworth, and Thomas Edison. The goal of the project was to determine what factors led to great success. Hill's 1937 book, Think and Grow Rich, is now one of the classics in the genre of self-help and has sold many millions of copies. The number one quality, the secret, he touts in the introduction that can be found on every page and in the life of every person he interviewed, is a burning desire to succeed. Call it the fire in the belly, a calling, the will to succeed, a work ethic, whatever. You will not find great success without this intense desire, this intense emotion. Think about the way many great generals put a lot of thought into getting their troops ready for battle. Why do you think we have military music? It's not sophisticated music. Someone, either Groucho Marx or George Clemenceau, I can't find a definitive source, once famously remarked, "Military justice is to justice, as military music is to music." But military music gets the job done. It pumps soldiers up and engages their emotions. So it is in the battle to achieve your goals. Without a fire in the belly, your efforts lack luster. Find and work within your sweet spot. If we were machines, then we wouldn't need to worry about the emotions that criticism might stir up, because there would be no emotion to stir up. Some might protest, "What do you mean? We employ adults. They are professionals. The paycheck should be all the praise they need. They should be able to take criticism, say thank you very much, benefit from it, make the recommended changes, and move on. Show me one person who is truly that professional. I suppose you might be able to find one if you looked long enough. But most of the time, you'll find people who pretend to be like that, then go home and mutter into their scotch about what a rotten place they work at. If you play golf, as I do, poorly, you've heard the phrase, "It will keep you coming back," referring to the effect of one good shot. When you do something well that's difficult to do, that's about as much fun as a person can have, at work anyway. No matter how many bad shots you hit and all the misery they caused you, that one good shot was so much fun it keeps you coming back for more. Finding the fun, at least at work, means to me finding that one good shot I make each day. Maybe two, maybe three or more. But usually, I make at least one. I try to hold on to that as I drive home. I try not to make the mistake of many people by reviewing each and every bad shot as they drive home. By doing that, you gradually condition yourself to hate your job. Who wants to go to a place of failure day in and day out? The old adage about learning from your mistakes is true enough, but new evidence suggests we actually improve more by dwelling on our successes than by reviewing mistakes. This is because the more you can associate work with success, the more you're going to want to go to work, and the more, ironically, you're going to be open to learning from your mistakes. Positive emotion allows you to focus better on what's difficult, while negative emotion leads you, over time, to use avoidance as a coping style. There is a subtle distinction here. Taken to the extreme, neither position works well. If you never look at a mistake and learn from it, you will endlessly repeat mistakes. On the other hand, if you never relish success and spend all your time dwelling on what you've done wrong, you will soon get depressed or simply become grim. I suggest only that you lean more toward relishing the good shots, however few they may be, than dissecting what you did poorly. Most people are not very good self-examiners anyway, so the effort to look at what went wrong is fraught with self-deception. But should another person, whom you trust and know has your best interests at heart, point out a mistake you've made, take it seriously. That person is doing you a favor, because he or she has a vantage point you can never have. Do yourself a favor. Rather than telling yourself to work harder, invoking the famous work ethic so many people rightly extol, it makes much better sense to put yourself in a position where your hardest work will naturally follow, without commands from above, without a strong work ethic, in fact, without any ethic at all. You will work your hardest because you want to. The work ethic becomes a passion for your work, a love for what you do, whatever you do. I'll call this working in your sweet spot. You can find your sweet spot by looking to see where three spheres intersect. The first sphere comprises all that you love to do. The second sphere comprises all that you have significant talent at doing. The third sphere comprises all that advances the mission you're on, or, put differently, all that someone will pay you to do. The intersection of these three spheres is the magical realm I call your sweet spot. The more time you spend in your sweet spot, the happier and more successful you'll be, the more likely you'll be in flexible focus or flow, and the more motivated to work hard you'll feel. On the other hand, the more time you spend outside your sweet spot, the more frustrated and deprived you'll feel, the more in F state and the less successful you will be. So let's say you are unhappy at work. you feel that you aren't using your talent or brains or training to their highest capacity, and you don't feel challenged. Do you simply draw a paycheck day after day? Or do you try to do something about it? Sadly, most people see no alternative but to accept their unhappiness. They fear that if they bring up their unhappiness to their supervisors, they will fall under suspicion or perhaps even lose their jobs. There is an even more unfortunate side effect to this attitude. If you are unhappy at work, it will spill out in one form or another, and very often in the form of self-sabotage. You may do your work poorly. You may come in late and leave early. You may do as Les did and waste time surfing the net. There are a million ways to ruin your professional career by not doing the most critical work of managing yourself. As a psychiatrist, I can tell you that the clients and patients I've worked with have been pleasantly surprised when they have an honest conversation with their supervisors. For example, once Les went through a course of therapy to break his internet addiction, he realized that he had been unhappy at work. So he went to his supervisor and said, "I'd like to have a conversation about how I'm being utilized at this company." He'd come to this conversation having done his homework. He had already located another position in the company that he thought would be a better fit for him. This honest conversation was helpful in several ways. Les was encouraged to apply for another lateral position in the firm in marketing, where he could use more of his creative skills and where he flourished. His supervisor was able to hire someone who was quite happy and successful in Les's old job. And Les went from being internet addicted, distracted, and disgruntled to sane, happy, and, well, gruntled. If you are a manager, don't wait to have these kinds of honest conversations with employees who may be reluctant to take the first step. Obviously, it's in everyone's best interest to have the right people with the right skills in the right positions. Much more efficient to move someone than to fire him and then rehire and train someone else. In managing your emotional life, try to set your default position to "life is good." The Roman Stoic philosopher Epictetus embodied the often ignored power of doing this. He was a crippled slave. Despite being beaten frequently, despite being crippled, and despite being owned by another person, he was happy. His master was so impressed that he told Epictetus he would free him if he could teach him how to be happy. Epictetus told his master that the one thing a person can control is his opinions. As he advised, "Do not seek to have events happen as you want them to, but instead want them to happen as they do happen, and your life will go well." Despite the wretched external circumstances of his life, Epictetus determined to hold the opinion that life was good, and to feel grateful for the chance to be alive. His master was so impressed that he freed Epictetus, who spent the rest of his life teaching others his philosophy. One of his students, Flavius Arianus, compiled his sayings into a small book, the Enchiridion, the Handbook, which Roman soldiers found so inspiring, they often read them just before marching into battle. By setting your default position at "life is good," you prime yourself not to fall into the swamps of negative emotion that surround life. Many sophisticated intellectuals scoff at this idea, deeming it simplistic, if not silly. Yet it has ancient and sturdy intellectual roots, as embodied in the life and work of the great Stoic philosopher. Negative feelings cloud focus and reduce your vim. So try to turn down the volume of the part of you that disagrees, that thinks life is lousy. How you feel, your emotional state, often creates the content of your thinking. Emotion can precede and indeed create the content of your thoughts. We usually assume that content, what's going on inside and outside our minds, creates emotion. but it can be just the opposite. What you feel can create what you think and what you do. The more you can be in a life is good frame of mind, the better you will do. Chapter 12. Harnessing the Power of Structure. Sister Joan Chittister, a Benedictine nun, writer, and speaker, takes part in the training and supervision of new members of her order. Early in their training, she asks her eager novitiates a basic question. Why do we pray? One new nun will raise her hand and say, "Because we love the Lord and wish to worship Him every day." "That's true," Sister Joan will reply, "but that's not why we pray." Perplexed and naive, another earnest young nun will raise her hand and propose, "We pray because we want to strengthen our spiritual connection with God." "Yes," Sister Joan will reply, "but that's not why we pray." By now, the nuns are feeling frustrated, as they believe they know perfectly well why they pray, and they wonder what other reason the revered Sister Joan could possibly have in mind. Another ardent nun summons up her courage and takes a stab at the question. "We pray," she pronounces, "to draw closer to Jesus and to quiet our troubled souls. We pray to lift our hearts and minds from worldly worries to the spiritual world. We pray to express gratitude and seek forgiveness." "That's all true," Sister Joan replies, "but that's not really why we pray." Yet another nun, hoping to be the one finally to get the right answer, raises her hand. "We pray because we're supposed to pray," she volunteers. Sister Joan smiles. "That's close," she says, "but that's not quite why we pray." She pauses, sensing the frustration in the room. What possible answer could she be looking for? All the frowning faces seem to be asking. "We pray," Sister Joan finally states, "because the bell rings." Each day, no matter what their mood or what their circumstances, the nuns all gather for worship when the bell rings. In the most practical and superficial sense, they gather because the bell rings. In the most fundamental of ways, they pray if for no other reason than it is simply what they do after the bell rings. That bell offers a perfect example of structure. Why work to create structure? Life depends upon structure. Throughout all of nature, we see magnificent examples of structures that allow for life. I've already described the constructal law and how it governs all movement, the very definition of life. But creating structure is difficult because it goes against a basic law of physics. When we think, we are trying to make order out of chaos. In doing so, we wrestle with the second law of thermodynamics, which states that nature tends toward a state of maximum disorder, or entropy. In thinking, as we work to bring order out of chaos, nature snaps at us, rebuffing our effort and recoils. "Keep out," nature seems to say. "I have my secrets, and they are mine to keep." But we mortals will not be put off. We must eat of the tree of knowledge. We persist in thinking, in trying to wrest order out of disorder, in trying to pry the secrets out of nature's hiding places. As exhausting and painful as it can be, we humans keep at it eternally. One reason we do it is to get paid. As Samuel Johnson said, "No man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money." But why pick such a frustrating line of work, the work of the mind, when there are so many easier ways to get paid? People do it, Johnson most assuredly included, because when it goes right, it feels good, perhaps better than anything else ever feels. It feels good to win one skirmish with entropy, to defeat the devil of disarray, to hammer out order, to create beauty, to perceive a pattern in what seemed random, to turn a witty phrase, to nail a perfect landing off the high bar of thought, to create a moment's harmony in a cacophonous relationship, to design a machine that does what you ask it to do, to write a sentence that says what you want it to say. In short, it feels good to prevail against the forces of destruction, forces that will one day bring every life down. But for one wondrous, weightless moment, you defy. Sometimes, rarely, a great idea actually jumps into your boat and you take it home. Oh, lucky day! But usually, you have to work, sometimes an entire lifetime, to land just one big one. If you are like Ashley, you get many bites, many new ideas hit your bait. But that is a far cry from reeling any one of them all the way in. How many people have had hundreds of ideas for a new business? But how many people actually start one, let alone one that succeeds? How many people think of an invention they can't wait to patent? But how many people actually take their invention to the market? How many people have a great idea for a book? But how many actually write and publish the book? How many people believe they're just one hit away from the big score? But how many score big? One moment you think you have a thought hooked, but then, with not so much as a fare thee well, it's gone. You're left wondering what happened, where it went, how it got away. Some of these fish have been hooked often before, only to have escaped many times. There they lie, like fat old trout, free, in a deep pool beneath a fallen tree, smugly looking up at you and me. Our best hope, Ashley's best hope, is to invent the right net, the right structure to catch them. As Dan Sullivan, a renowned teacher of entrepreneurs, says, "The best ideas are caught, not taught." Such is the power of structure that it can dictate, facilitate, and bring order to most everything we do. It is imperative in today's crazy busy world to create structures that enable you to do what you want to do, and prevent you from doing what you do not want to do. Some examples of structure: an appointment book, a closed door, an open door, a rhyme scheme, a switch in the off position, a day set aside to rest, grammar, the opening bell, a list, a date night, rhythm, an alarm clock, laws, an egg timer next to your computer, politeness, equations, biting your tongue, seasons. The idea that to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven. You must act and do. You have no choice. Every day you act and do until you can't. While you can ignore the sensational six practices and do nothing to get your brain ready for action, or do nothing to create the optimal emotional state in which to act, you cannot avoid taking action. All day, every day, you act. Your brain fires signals nonstop, day and night. Barring brain death, your brain is going to act whether you want it to or not until you die. Structure is a simple-sounding but truly life-changing tool that allows you to plan and control in order to achieve your goals. A plan is itself an excellent example of structure. Without structure is chaos. Without structure, you get sidetracked. Without structure, you go off on tangents, hopping from one great opportunity to the next, but capitalizing on none of them. Emotion goes unchecked. Distractions and interruptions flood your world. Your thoughts and actions zigzag and vector like snowflakes in a snow squall, a flurry of activity that bursts upon the scene, then disappears just as quickly. An invisible haze holds many people back. Their days lack direction and coherence due to lack of structure. Each time they try to reach the next level of achievement, they fall back, as if blocked by the haze that they cannot see. The haze may be caused by disorganization, lack of focus, poorly defined goals, loss of energy, depression, overcommitment, lack of support, or a host of other obstacles. The way to penetrate the haze is to create structures that burn right through it. With structure, with a plan, a schedule, a prioritization of your goals, you can put yourself in position to win, to do what your best self wants you to do. If you're a nun, you put yourself in a pew to pray because the bell rings and tells you to. If you're a trader on the stock exchange, you put yourself on the exchange floor and start making trades when that particular bell rings because it allows you to. Ironically, many creative people resist structure and thereby sabotage their best selves. Aspiring entrepreneurs like Ashley have said to me, "I can't be tied down to a routine or a flowchart. I need to have the freedom to do what I want, when I want. I'm too independent and creative to be tied down." To those people, I say, good luck. Come back and see me when you're tired of underachieving. If they do come back, I say, okay, now let's make friends with structure. Start by looking at arguably the two greatest creative geniuses who ever lived, Shakespeare and Mozart. Take Shakespeare. Almost every play he wrote was in blank verse. Iambic pentameter. Da-da, 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 da-da. If music be the food of love, four iambs. But then comes play on, aspondi, two stressed syllables. So Shakespeare was not a metronomic slave to iamb after iamb. But the form gave him the basic structure within which he could create endless variety. Without the form of blank verse, he would have had no boundaries to cross, no pattern to work against, and we would have a mess instead of the greatest, most majestic, yet intricate beauty ever achieved in the English language, indeed, in any language at all. Mozart composed within tight musical forms that led to monotonous music in the hands of other composers. But in Mozart's hands, those forms led to boundless variety. Much of the beauty and excitement of his music derives from its element of surprise. But the surprise is only a surprise due to the expectation set by the structure Mozart was working within. While his contemporaries, most notably Antonio Salieri, composed good music, their scores lacked the transcendence and originality of Mozart. He drove his competitors into fits of envy. But Mozart would never have been able to make what he did of his genius had he not mastered the forms and structure within which he composed. Far from being the killjoy many creative people fear structure to be, it is quite the opposite. It facilitates joy. Creating structure. The failure to use simple structures leads to ongoing underachievement. Usually, it is not a lack of awareness that some structure, like a list, might help, but rather an inability to use a structure or tool you know will help. To tap the power of structure, take a specific problem or goal of yours and ask yourself, what sort of structure might help me solve this problem or achieve this goal? For example, let's say your goal is to get more exercise. This is a common goal. Yet, it is one that eludes most people. For every jogger you see running the roads, there are dozens who wish they were, or are resolving so to do, as they drive past. The best way to make sure you get enough exercise is to schedule it. Schedule equals structure. Pick a time, say 7 a.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and put it into your calendar. If you worry you might sleep in, schedule the exercise with someone so you have to show up or let the other person down. If even that fails, then hire a trainer, so if you skip, you still have to pay for the session. This is a variation on Sister Joan's bell. You don't have to decide to go to the gym because the decision has been made in advance. It is what you do at the appointed time on the appointed day. You can actually put a lot of creativity into developing structure. For example, I once treated a woman who had a problem with impulsive overspending. She ran up large credit card debt, to the point where her financial advisor wanted her to get rid of all her credit cards. But she didn't want to give them up altogether in case she really needed them. She came up with the following solution. She took the credit cards and put them into a bowl of water. She then put the bowl of water into the freezer. The credit cards would be there should she really need them, but they would be separated from her impulse to spend by a barrier of ice. That's genius-level structure. A decision is an act of creating structure, like an on-off switch. I will do this, I will not do that. People often try to wiggle out of this kind of structure, as it limits their freedom. Outline for setting goals. 1. Short term. Set 3 goals per day. Only 3. Having too many goals chokes progress. Once you achieve the 3, if there's still time, you can set another, then another. 2. Medium term. Set 3 goals per 2-week term. 3. Long term. Set 3 goals per 6 months to a year. 4. Lifetime. Define your lifetime goals. This list may exceed 3 items, but be careful not to make it too long. Of course, these may change at any time, but the exercise is worthwhile to define what you want to achieve before you die. 5. Assess your progress regularly. This improves focus and motivation, even if you were falling short. 6. Review and revise. Review your goals regularly. It is the best way to keep your mind fresh. You can revise these lists at any time. Write them down, as they have a way of morphing in your mind into forms you didn't intend. Even if you do not revise them, check on them periodically to make sure you are on track. Setting goals in an organized fashion forces you to do one of the most difficult and important tasks in today's world. Prioritize. The great achievement of modern life is also its curse. You can do so much. In order to turn that curse into a blessing, you must prioritize. Clearly defined goals, short, medium, and long-term, and lifetime, focus the mind marvelously. Crazy Busy App. To help people structure their days, I created an app called Crazy Busy, which you can download for free. It contains various features, including one that allows you to input variables that lead to the calculation of a worth-it factor of a given task to help you decide if you should do it. It also contains a stopwatch, tips on managing modern life, an assessment tool to let you visualize where you are actually spending your time. You'd be amazed at how most people are quite unaware of this. Various brain games and focus exercises, and methods for preserving C-state, calm, concentrated, careful, creative, and avoiding F-state, frustrated, forgetful, frantic, feckless. The user-friendly app offers a simple, practical way to add structure to your day, getting more done that needs to get done, while avoiding the unimportant but time-consuming tasks and activities. Make it fun. A big reason people don't create the structures that could help them is that they believe it is tedious. It seems onerous. Boring. To take full advantage of the power of creating structures, it's best to make doing so fun. As Stephen Kotler wrote, "What's painfully ironic is that flow is a radical and alternative path to mastery only because we have decided that play, an activity fundamental to survival, tied to the greatest neurochemical rewards the brain can produce, and flat out necessary for achieving peak performance, creative brilliance, and overall life satisfaction is a waste of time for adults. If we are hunting the highest version of ourselves, then we need to turn work into play and not the other way around. Unless we invert this equation, much of our capacity for intrinsic motivation starts to shut down. We lose touch with our passion and become less than what we could be. Making a game out of structure can turn the humdrum into the appealing. It can also force a change in behavior. For example, Volkswagen sponsored a contest in Germany to reduce the number of people who drove above the speed limit. The winner of the contest created a speeding lottery, in which each car that passed a camera had its speed noted. If the car was speeding, the driver received a citation in the mail. But if the car was obeying the speed limit, that driver received a check drawn from the pool of money collected from the speeders. Once the speeding lottery was set up, the average speed at the sight of the camera dropped from 32 kilometers per hour to 25. A 21% reduction. In Sweden, a contest was held to encourage pedestrians to take the stairs rather than the adjacent escalator when coming up from a subway station. The winning entry turned the stairs into piano notes so that the person climbing the stairs created a musical tone with every step. Users of the stairs increased dramatically, up 66%. In a park in Europe, a trash bin was rigged with a device that made the whining sound of a bomb being dropped, capped off with the sound of an explosion when a piece of trash was dropped into the bin. The responsive sound intrigued kids, who started looking for trash to throw away. Adults did as well. The rigged bin took in 72 kilograms of trash in one day, compared to the normal bin across the park that only took in 41 kilograms on the same day. Another contest encouraged more people to recycle bottles by putting them into a sidewalk bottle bin. The winner of the contest came up with the idea of turning the bin into an arcade, so that when you put a bottle in, lights flashed, music played, and a score appeared on a screen. On the first evening, nearly 100 people used the bottle bin arcade, while only 2 people used the normal bin across town. Just as turning a bottle bin into an arcade can help people do the otherwise dull task of bringing bottles to a recycling center, so can adding novelty to any drab task turn it into a task a person is more likely to perform. Like the innovators at thefunnytheory.com, any of us can use imagination to turn drudgery into a task we will do rather than avoid. Practical solutions. Think of a specific problem or goal that you have. Then ask yourself, how could a different structure help me? The new structure you develop may be at the macro level, such as finding a different job or buying a new information storage system. Or it may be at the micro level, such as moving a meeting to a time of day when you tend to focus better, or asking your assistant to deny interruptions during the 10 a.m. hour every Wednesday so you can think. The key is to be creative and also to think big in terms of the powerful difference a new structure can make in your life. Get well enough organized to do your work, but don't think your organization must be perfect. The best structures are the ones you invent yourself. Get into the habit of thinking in terms of external structure that can help you overcome internal obstacles. Finally, remember, curtail, delegate, and eliminate, CDE. The more you can simplify your life, the more structural control you will gain. At first, CDE seems difficult. After all, everything is there for a reason, right? Wrong. Most of us have allowed clutter to fill not only our desks, closets, cars, and drawers, but also our schedules. Much as I touted the ringing of the bell as an excellent reason to pray or do anything, we also can become blind slaves to bells we neither set up nor desire. They become like car alarms going off in empty parking lots. So, go through your life, both your physical spaces and schedules, wielding a scalpel ruthlessly, ready to cut all you can. Once you curtail, delegate, and eliminate, leave the free space empty, at least for a while. The law of the physics for modern life is that you must take your time, or it will be taken from you. Chapter 13. Distracted No More. I work in the hope business. I work in a world of trying to help if-onlys come true. One of the rewards of my job is discovering that no situation is ever so dire that hope cannot spark within it, given the right fanning of the embers. I've also learned that people, for the most part, do the best they can. They cobble together a life, sometimes turn it into a shambles, but even in the shambles, they are doing their best at that particular time. Few people intend to do less well than they can. A great phrase that Joseph Wood Crutch attributes to Anatole France succinctly sums up what I have learned we all do. Chacun fait son salut comme il peut. Everyone seeks his salvation as he may. That phrase expresses the idea, both of the comprehensive liberty there granted and of that sweeping refusal to make moral distinctions which is implied in the masterfully malicious adroitness with which the single word salut is made to include any desire which a man may have, from Augustine's thirst for God on down to the last perverse whim which has taken possession of the debauchee whose desires are, no doubt, just as imperious and as little to be questioned as are those of anyone else. Each of the six characters I created for this book was doing the best he or she could at the time. Revisiting the six characters makes for a fitting conclusion to our journey into the world of attention deficit trait, or ADT, personal focus, and individual psychology. Here's how each of the characters might have progressed. Les suffered with an addiction. His addiction was the newest one, electronics. In helping Les to see that he was medicating himself, to use Edward Kantzian's term I cited in Chapter 1, with his electronics, I was able to get him to address the larger matter. What disease, or dis-ease, was he trying to medicate? In his case, it was a low-grade depression born out of a fear that he didn't have the talent to live up to the expectations that his wife, his boss, and he himself had. Once he was able to modify his use of electronics, he became better able to work with Carl, his boss, and begin to unwrap his considerable gifts at work, which, of course, translated into progress at home as well. Jean's effort to reclaim her life was not easy. As with all people, change comes slowly, haltingly, and with setbacks. However, when she did see and feel the shipwreck of her life, the idea that came to her was more of a command. "I've simply got to take back control," she said to herself. "I can't let myself get pushed around." When insight actually helps and leads to change, it is usually not the novelty of the insight or its brilliance that helps, because most important insights regarding one's life are neither novel nor brilliant. Indeed, they are usually quite mundane, because they've occurred to people millions of times before. Know yourself. Speak the truth. Follow your passion. Be true to who you are. Don't worship false idols. Focus on what matters most. Don't live your life for and through others. Understand that your boss is not your father or mother. Be real. Stick up for yourself. Realize you are no longer a child. Each of these commonplace insights can change a life dramatically for the better. What gives an insight its power is the context in which it occurs, its timing. When Jean felt the pain of her circumstance in the extreme, saw her shipwreck, to use Ortega's term, then the ordinary insight, I have more control than I am using, took on great power. She used her newfound strength to take many of the steps I've recommended throughout, from cutting back on commitments to finding warm connections with friends to preserving time alone for meditation and standing up to her spouse. It was not easy, but desperation led her to change. Ashley suffered with one of life's most crippling afflictions, a narcissistic parent, in her case, her mother. However, it need not ruin her life. As I've stated and have seen repeatedly, nothing need ruin a life. There is always, always hope. In one of our sessions, Ashley came up against how cruel her mother had been, how jealous and selfish. I sat with Ashley as she welled up. "This will never change, will it?" she asked me. "What your mother did will never change. But what you feel and do can absolutely change." "Really?" she asked. "Tell me the truth, damn it." "I'm telling you the truth. You can walk out of the desert your mother created." At that moment, she dared to hope, where she had not dared before. Now, she had to practice hope. And she had to practice making decisions, adding structure to her life, eating and sleeping better, and making love more often. All these forces, the psychological, the practical, the physiological, combined to create the progress she made. Jack was so wedded to worry that he lost the woman he wed. Worry was in his genes and in his early upbringing. To let go of toxic worry would require Jack to be willing to give up the very state of mind in which, ironically, he felt most safe. Medication made a big difference for Jack. At first, he was unwilling to take it. But when he saw how empty his life was becoming, when he saw the shipwreck, he decided something had to give. In prescribing Zoloft for him, I picked a serotonin reuptake inhibitor because the neurotransmitter is key in regulating worry, anxiety, and mood. Medication gave Jack a jumpstart, but he needed more than just that. I prescribed vigorous daily physical exercise, perhaps the best medication of all for toxic worry, as well as hefty doses of Vitamin Connect. Jack and I met regularly for over a year. He used our sessions to reorient himself in the world of imagination and test out life with less toxic worry. While he never freed himself of toxic worry altogether, he did become able to approach his wife and show her a different enough version of himself that the family reunited. Mary's problem was that her focus on others had saved not only her, but her entire family while she was growing up. To relinquish that habit would be to enter what she felt to be highly dangerous territory. But she was miserable as an adult, taking care of everyone but herself. I worked with her to help her understand that taking care of oneself is not selfish, in the negative meaning of that word, but selfish in the best sense. Only by taking care of oneself is one able to take care of others. In bearing with the tension of feeling selfish, Mary could see the shipwreck she'd created. In that state of despair, the idea that came to her was crude and simple. Screw this. Anger flooded her. Good anger. Anger she'd pushed away for decades. She lived with that anger for months and allowed it to guide away situations she used to plow right into, people and projects in distress. I prescribed exercise, meditation, and a regular lunch with a friend. I urged Mary to talk to her friend about herself, not just about the friend, to learn how to do it. To her pleasure and amazement, the friend liked hearing about Mary and noted how this was so different. She would backslide from time to time, but her fundamental insight, that she did not want to sacrifice her life to the pleasure of others, nor did she need to for others to survive, put her on a track toward a better life. Sharon's progress was most dramatic of all, because she had a treatable condition that usually responds quickly and powerfully to the interventions we are lucky enough to have. The lesson to be learned from Sharon is how important it is that the public understand not only ADHD, but learning differences in general. From David Neeleman to Richard Branson to Charles Schwab, some of our most talented people have learning differences. We need to start recognizing the enormous talents often embedded in learning differences. As we come to the end of this journey into modern life and the common mistakes people make as they work to stay on track, let me offer a few summarizing suggestions on how to stay focused, boost productivity, and remain sane. 1. Prioritize and focus on what matters most. This minute, this hour, this day, this week, this year, this decade, this lifetime. 2. Recognize the unmatched power of love and the human connection in everyday life. 3. Download the Crazy Busy app. Create boundaries that make it impossible for you to be pulled in too many directions at once. Remember the constructal law. Remove obstacles to free flow. 4. Recognize that pleasure is not the same as joy, and that stimulation is not the same as substance. 5. Allow for downtime. Remember, when you are doing nothing, your brain and its default network are doing a lot. 6. Preserve the human moment. Don't allow the electronic moment to overrun your life. 7. Learn to take care of yourself. Say no. Don't give everything away. 8. Don't assume that working harder is the answer. Most likely, working smarter is. This whole book has been about how to work smarter. 9. Work as much as possible in your sweet spot. The overlap of what you love to do, what you're good at doing, and what advances the mission or someone will pay you to do. 10. Try to follow the basic plan. Energy, emotion, engagement, structure, control. Cheerleading. I've offered a plan to master the magic of mental clarity. A plan that, once understood, leads you to see that mental clarity needs no magic at all, just science in action. I've suggested that in this era, we need to be more deliberate, even scientific, about creating and sustaining flexible focus than ever before, because the thieves of our attention, even of our very minds, are cleverer and more predatory than anyone dreamed they could become. We live in an utterly different world from that of even 2 decades ago, teeming with possibility, shining with hope in places, but shrouded in doubt and fear in others. It is a world that can take us over, if we're not careful. More control of our minds is up for grabs than it's ever been in history. Once a fine and private place, the mind is private no more. Now it is critical to know how to own, manage, protect, and develop your mind according to your own desires, not someone else's, while not being sucked into the whirlpool of useless but seductive information, ideas, and rhetoric. By learning how to cultivate the state of mind I've named flexible focus, a state in which you can both come up with new ideas as well as develop them fully, you can take charge of modern life rather than letting it take charge of you. The stupefied screen sucker, so common now in the workplace, symbolizes the jeopardy this modern world flirts with every day. But just as we've never been so vulnerable to attack, we've never been as powerful. By taking charge and by learning the skill of regulating focus, not only can you improve your own mind and develop it according to your own desires rather than someone else's, but you can also succeed far beyond what you imagined was possible. That's because never before has so much been possible. Be creative. Be like the people who turned stairs into piano notes. Don't let your ideas melt like snowflakes on warm pavement. Catch them, preserve them, feed them, and systematically see to it that they grow. Court flow. Maintain your mental energy at its best. Follow the sensational six practices. Get into the right emotional space created by working in your sweet spot. Build the structures that will allow you to achieve in ways that will satisfy you beyond what you thought possible. Am I cheerleading you? You bet I am. And I urge you to cheerlead others. We need to cheer for each other. Most people suffer from a deficit of good news, encouragement, and positive energy. It's hard to supply that for yourself, but not so hard to give it to someone else. While neuroscientists like Matthew Lieberman are proving what St. Francis said centuries ago. In giving, we receive. We need each other. We need to get in the habit of giving routinely to each other, especially in a world that is silently separating us interpersonally, even as it joins us electronically. We need to preserve and promote human moments. We need to run the show. Not let our devices run us. There may have been a more exciting, uncertain time to be alive, but I can't think of one. The best way to take advantage of the teeming opportunities of our era is by learning how to master your mind, learning the skill of flexible focus, and tapping into the powers that positive energy and emotion can unleash, propelling you to do far more than you may have believed you could. And to hold, cherish, and develop what matters most. Epilogue. Ultimately, you will decide for yourself whether my solutions work better than what you're already doing. Speaking personally, I can tell you they've worked for me and my wife. We both have careers. My wife works part-time as a psychotherapist, she is a social worker by training, and does a great deal of volunteer work. I have an active private practice and also write books, this being my 20th. We depend on our work to pay our bills, as neither of us has family money, and putting our three children through private schools and college, our youngest enrolled at Trinity in the fall of 2014, has taken most of what we otherwise would have saved. So we live from paycheck to paycheck. While at times we feel overwhelmed, even desperate, we find ways to do what matters most to us and have some time to relax as well. This has cost us income, to be sure. We have far less money than most of our friends, but has preserved our sanity and health and kept us close as a family. My wife goes to the gym 4 days a week and has a regular dinner group, book group, exercise group, and just because we're friends group. I go to the gym regularly as well, have a squash game I've been playing bi-weekly with the same man, my best friend, for over 30 years, and I watch a lot of TV, while my wife reads many books. We have always spent lots of time with our kids, be it family dinners, soccer games, school events, Sundays at the Patriots games, we've been season ticket holders since 1993, family vacations, or just hanging out. We live in a suburb of Boston, an area that is as high-pressured and super busy as any area in the country, with the possible exception of New York, where I also have an office, and our daughter now lives. All this is to say that I practice what I preach, and that I live in the midst of the world about which I write. I am not a dispassionate academic observing from the sidelines. I am very much in the game. And I have come to learn it is a game that need not overwhelm even its most intense players. Of course, more enlightened social policies would work wonders to allow more people to lead saner lives, such as universal childcare or compensation for time spent as a caregiver or parent. That my wife and I have professional degrees makes earning a living far easier for us than for those who do not. but I do believe that the solutions I outline in this book can help anyone who chooses to try them to reduce overload and regain sanity, and in so doing, become more productive, both at work and at home.